From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. A new highway is almost completed, a highway that will cross South America. It opens up access to hard-to-reach places, and with that access come threats. On the Interoceanic Highway, you can travel to pristine, old-growth rainforest. Environmentalists are concerned that the road will endanger the rainforest and its unique plants and animals. In the final story in our series on the highway, NPR's Lourdes Garcia Navarro got a close-up look in the Peruvian Amazon at what environmentalists are trying to conserve.
So what sound is that?
This is long-crested pygmy tyrant, very difficult to see.
Ramiro Yavar is one of the foremost birders in Peru. In a clearing in the forest, he plays a recording of the call of the long-crested pygmy tyrant, hoping it will attract one so he can get a glimpse. He goes on in Spanish.
Este transecto de Manu contiene 1,005 especies.
In this area alone, there are 1,500 species of birds. On the planet, there are about 9,000 species of birds. So almost 15% of all the birds globally you can see here.
Peru's Amazon basin is considered one of the most biodiverse places in the world, and Los Amigos Research Station, a scientific outpost that supports study of the Amazon, is perhaps one of the best places to see the amazing wealth of plants, insects, and animals this region is home to. We've come here after a grueling trip down the Interoceanic Highway, and the warm, wet foliage of the rainforest envelops us. As we're walking, we see a group of monkeys high up in the canopy. Enrique Ortiz is a biologist and one of the co-founders of the Amazon Conservation Association, which runs Los Amigos. He imitates the monkey's call.
Tocón, 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 tocón. So locally they're called tocón.
They're not very aggressive?
No, they are actually very tame and quiet. But sometimes they come a bit vicious. They pee on you and they start showing their genitals. This is when they want you to go away. They are funny.
As we continue through the forest, he tells us there are a remarkable 13 types of monkey here and 120 species of bats. Suddenly, though, the going gets tough.
So before I came out into the forest, I had to put on these big, huge, bright yellow rubber boots. And I can tell you, I needed them. Right now we are tramping through almost knee-high mud, and every step I take, my foot keeps on getting stuck in the mud. I have to wrench it out and keep on going. It's a bit of a slog.
Finally, we arrive at an oxbow lake, home sometimes to the endangered giant otter. The otter family that hunts in these waters isn't here today, but researcher Sean Denny says he's seen the rare creatures.
I saw them once here, and they were kind of either curious or upset that that was here. So when they do come out, they're pretty noisy and conspicuous. And
they'll
make a lot of noise. Well, they're interesting looking. They kind of have bulging eyes, which is kind of weird. They have this white mottled neck, and otherwise they're sort of this chocolatey brown.
All this is located in one of the world's first ever conservation concessions, Los Amigos.
Los Amigos is about 140,000 hectares, so it's bigger than most national parks in the world. As protected areas go, it's a good chunk of land.
Adrian Forsyth is the president of the Amazon Conservation Association, which runs the Los Amigos concession. Normally, governments grant oil concessions and mining concessions. A conservation concession functions in the same way. The stewards of the area are in a long-term contractual partnership with the national government. But the purpose, instead of the extraction of natural resources, is ecosystem and biodiversity conservation. Forsyth helped found Los Amigos in 2001. Since then, other groups have adopted his model, and conservation concessions have multiplied.
To a biologist, this has to count as one of the most important places on the planet, because we have this tremendous concentration of biodiversity where the Andes runs up against the Amazon, and it's where, if you think in a few hundred years from now, we'll have been smart enough to stabilize population and consumption so that we can live in health on the planet, we're still going to go through this tremendous bottleneck of loss of habitat and species before we reach that point. So where are the safe havens where we might carry through the largest number of species that will eventually need to rebuild the planet's health? And it's places like this.
Forsyth sees this place as a conservationist's Noah's Ark.
If you were a Martian looking down at planet Earth, you would remark on the fact that this is largely a lifeless ball of molten rock floating in a lifeless vacuum of deep space, except for this thin little skin of life with an atmosphere around it, and that thin little skin has become patchy and frayed and gray and brown, and there are a few of these beautiful, green, healthy, intact ecosystems.
Areas that have to be preserved, he says. It remains to be seen what effect the interoceanic highway will have, but unless there is some sort of plan of how to mitigate the impact, Forsyth fears the worst.
Well, I think the road can be a destructive force or it can be a positive force. I don't think there's any doubt that every country needs a certain amount of road networks, and I think the road doesn't have to be a disaster. It only has to be a disaster if it's simply treated as a way to have a free-for-all exploitation of the landscape and simply allow people to come and do whatever they want to maximize their profit.
The interoceanic highway that goes through this part of Peru is a fait accompli. It's in its final stages. Forsyth and his group are continuing to try to protect what they can. With funding from American philanthropists, Forsyth and his team founded last year the area's first conservation concession managed by an indigenous group. The Arambaqueros Huachipiri Conservation Concession protects 17,000 acres of rainforest. The philosophy here, though, is not only to protect the forest, but also to allow researchers to come and study what threatens it. The dining room at Los Amigos serves as a busy general meeting place for the many researchers who use the facilities, including Peggy Schrum.
I'm a PhD student at Clemson University, here researching raptors for mercury toxicity.
Her research has shown that Amazonian birds of prey are showing high levels of mercury poisoning because of the gold mining activity in the area. Mercury is used in the gold extraction process in this region, but she says its effects are being felt far and wide.
I found the highest levels in forest interior birds, which are nowhere near the river, nowhere near the mining, which really surprised me. And I also found levels in a clean area, an area 6 hours upriver from here where there is no mining, a protected area. Those levels were equal to my levels here in the contaminated area, which was also surprising.
It is work that will help scientists understand the effects of alluvial mining on the fauna here. It's starting to get dark outside, and everyone suddenly leaves the dining room and walks to the edge of a cliff, which overlooks an endless expanse of unbroken forest. This daily ritual, those who stay here say, reminds them of nature's magnificence, but also of its fragility.
It's about 5:15 in the evening, and there is one event that no one at the research station misses, and that's the setting of the sun. They say every evening it's different, but every evening it's spectacular, and I can attest to that. In front of me, the sun is slowly going down. The clouds are a vivid orange and red. Below that is the green canopy of the jungle, and then the river slowly winding its way past. This is Lourdes Garcia Navarro, NPR News, in the Los Amigos Research Station, Peru.
You can hear all of Lourdes' stories from along the Interoceanic Highway and see some incredible photos from her trip, as well as a map of the Interoceanic Highway, all of that at npr.org.
As Congress works on health care, it's also taking on another overhaul effort. It's the $92 billion student loan market. The House is expected to vote on a bill today that would allow students to borrow directly from the U.S. Treasury instead of from private lenders subsidized by the government. House Democrats say this would save billions in the long run, but the bill has opponents in the loan industry and obstacles in the Senate. NPR's Audie Cornish reports.
For the last 35 years, the government has been subsidizing private banks and lenders so that they'll make loans to students. That's meant guaranteeing lenders up to 97% of the loans that aren't paid back while the companies keep the profits.
This is a really, really good deal for private lenders. It is a deal that costs the American taxpayer approximately $8 to $9 billion a year that we don't need to spend in that fashion.
That's House Democrat Timothy Bishop of New York. Bishop sits on the Education and Labor Committee that produced the legislation. The bill proposes shutting down the Federal Family Education Loan Program, fronted by private lenders, as soon as next year. Instead, students would borrow directly from the U.S. Treasury. House Democrats say this will insulate students from swings in the private lending market and keep their interest rates low. Speaker Nancy Pelosi touted the bill as a win-win at a press conference on the steps of the Capitol earlier this week.
This means that many more students can enter college, that they will graduate with less debt, that the federal loan initiatives that they and their families depend upon are strengthened for decades to come, and that taxpayers will save money.
But just how much isn't clear. There have been conflicting reports that put the number between $40 and $87 billion over the next 10 years. And it's important because Democrats already have designs on where they want to spend it. Under the bill, the Perkins Loan Program would be expanded to more students, and Pell Grant awards for low-income borrowers would increase. School construction projects around the country would get a $4 billion boost. Community colleges could expect $10 billion for renovations and adult retraining programs, additional money slotted for other programs. It's a list that makes Republicans like North Carolina's Virginia Fox wary.
The bill creates 9 new programs and increases the federal government takeover of early education, higher education, school construction, and more. It is an insidious intrusion into education at all levels by the federal government.
The healthcare debate has turned phrases like government takeover and public option into slurs on Capitol Hill, and industry lobbyists are seizing on the sentiment in the debate over student loans.
Even last week, if you listen to the president address Congress, he made a very strong point that a fundamental part of his plan is that there is a public option and a private option to make the whole system better.
That's Jeff Nordhook, the head of the student loan company, Nelnet.
What they're doing is eliminating the private option. And that, I think, should be frightening for people, that we are all forced to go to the federal government to borrow to go to school.
Moreover, loan providers like Nelnet have customer service reps, loan collection workers, and other kinds of employees spread throughout the country. The industry estimates some 35,000 jobs could be lost as a result. Democrat Ben Nelson represents Nelnet's home state of Nebraska.
And I'm very concerned about the 1,000 jobs in Nebraska that this represents. I just can't imagine why we need to have another 1,000 jobs in Washington and 1,000 less jobs in Nebraska.
Other senators are facing complaints from universities back home who worry that a federal bureaucracy can't handle the strain of all 8 million student loans by next summer. And some senators have their own ideas on where to spend the savings, and they look very different from the House list. Audie Cornish, NPR News, The Capitol.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep in Houston.
And I'm Renee Montaigne at NPR West in California. This week, we've been looking back on the financial crisis of the past year, and one question hangs over all the others. What are the chances the world will go through this again? NPR's Tom Gelton has been speaking with international economists about what steps need to be taken to avoid an even more serious crisis in the future. The consensus? There's still a rough road ahead.
Remember, this was a global financial crisis. It arose because of problems in the international economy, not just in one country. Economists generally agree the whole global financial system had become unstable and vulnerable to a meltdown. Basically, the world economy was out of balance. Countries with big trade surpluses, like China and Germany, had too much money to spare. They loaned it to countries with big deficits. Overall, lots of reckless lending and borrowing. Finance writer Satyajit Das says it was a giant Ponzi scheme.
And everybody's walking around enjoying the prosperity. But that is inherently an unstable system.
If we don't want it to crash again, the global economy has to be rebuilt on a more balanced basis, with more discipline by both lenders and borrowers. Growth can't be based so much on debt. But here's the problem. To avoid a worldwide depression, the United States and other countries in the short run did exactly the opposite of what they needed to do for the long run. Reckless spending got us in trouble. So what did governments do to get us out? They increased their spending, even as we consumers were cutting back on ours.
What they're doing is racking up a heck of a lot of money on their credit card rather than on yours and mine.
Around the world, it's the same story.
The reaction has been to deal with the short term first and worry about the longer term later.
Ishwar Prasad of Cornell University says the big players, the U.S., China, Japan, the Europeans, all felt they had no choice but to take dramatic short-term steps to revive the global economy. But that left the long-term needs.
In the process of climbing out of the hole that we dug ourselves into, we have put off some of the pain for the future. I think the reality is that a lot more adjustment will have to come.
In the United States, we borrow from China and other countries to finance our excess spending. But the more dollars we borrow, the more we drive up interest rates. The dollar then gets overvalued. Foreign goods get cheaper. U.S. goods get more expensive. We import more, export less, and the trade deficit goes up. If we paid more of our own way, we wouldn't need to borrow so much. It would be easier to trim our trade deficit. But at the moment, we're headed in the opposite direction, says Fred Bergsten, director of the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
We've done projections here at our institute that show that the trade deficit is going to get much, much larger again and go back, in fact, to unprecedented levels unless we bring the budget deficit under control.
Economists say the U.S. needs to sell more goods abroad and import less. China and Germany would be exporting less, importing more. But all this can happen only if the dollar goes down in value. And this adjustment would be painful for all sides. Consider the Chinese and German workers who produce goods for export to the U.S. Ishwar Prasad.
If you did have a fall in the value of the U.S. dollar, the rest of the world actually would have to take on a very significant burden of adjustment.
Add it all up. Reduced government spending in the U.S. would mean budget cutbacks and slower growth. Restructuring the economies in China, Germany, and other exporting countries could mean higher unemployment in export industries. Satyajit Das, a former debt trader, wonders whether governments will tell their people the truth, that to avoid another global crisis, they'll have to take bitter medicine.
The problem is there is no government in the world which wants to admit that. Because to go to your electorate promising them austerity and hardship is really not a vote-winning strategy.
Fred Bergsten of the Peterson Institute describes himself as an optimist, but he says the United States and other governments have not yet faced what they'll need to do in the next couple of years.
This is a very narrow tightrope, and maneuvering it just right is going to be much more difficult than the policy response to the original crisis itself.
A sobering thought just a year after the crisis broke. Tom Gelton, NPR News, Washington.
Our producer, Anne-Marie Baldonado, books a lot of our movie and TV guests, so we sent her to the Toronto Film Festival to scout out interesting movies and future guests. She saw 20 movies that were at the festival. It started last Thursday and concludes this Saturday. Now that Anne-Marie is back, we asked her to tell us about it. So, Anne-Marie, in the world of film festivals, what's the Toronto Film Festival's niche?
Well, first of all, it's known as a really people-friendly festival. You know, unlike Sundance or Cannes, regular people go to the screenings. Regular people from the city buy the tickets. They line up. And so they're seeing these movies with film critics from around the world and also with studio execs, either people who have films here or people who are looking to buy films to distribute. They're all seeing these movies together. And the rep about Toronto crowds is that they're very generous. You know, just think about if you're a regular film goer and you get to see a movie that no one else has seen and maybe the star of the film is in the theater with you, you're going to be sort of generous to it. And lots of studios like to bring their films here because of the fact that they're probably going to get a better reception than like at a festival where mostly it's film critics in the audience or something. But also it's sort of the unofficial kickoff of the Oscar season. You know, it's the fall and studios release the films that they think are going to be kind of art housey or films that are in Oscar contention. They bring them here and launch them and hope that showing them here to generous crowds can give them a little bit of a buzz and a little bit of a push that will sort of propel them to the end of the year and get their films nominated. And this year in particular, it's important because of the economic climate. There are fewer films. Studios have fewer films that they're releasing. And at the same time, the Oscars have expanded their list of Best Picture nominees from 5 to 10. So, you know, that's a lot of spots to fill. So I think people are thinking if they make a big impact at the Toronto Film Festival, they might be on that list.
So are there films that are getting that Oscar buzz at the festival?
Yeah, I would say the film that is getting the most buzz is actually my favorite film of the festival, a film called Up in the Air. It's Jason Reitman's third film. Jason Reitman's first two films actually both showed in Toronto and did well. The first is Thank You for Smoking, and the second was Juno, which 2 years ago did really well, Oscar-wise.
The film Up in the Air is based on a novel that I really love by Walter Kern. And the novel, a lot of it is set on an airplane because it's about somebody who has accumulated all these frequent flyer miles and his goal is to get more. And I read the book on an airplane, on several airplanes. And so I just really loved it because there's so many descriptions of like airports and lousy fluorescent lighting in airports and being next to passengers who are talking to you when you don't want to talk and so on. So what's the movie like?
Well, actually, I think Jason Reitman really captures what you're talking about. But he uses the book as a jumping off point. And in a press conference, he was talking about writing the film. He's been writing it for a few years now. The Kern book came out in 2001. And he said when he originally started writing it, I should back up and say that this traveler, the main character of Up in the Air, who's played by George Clooney, his job, he's sort of a corporate hitman. He's the guy that companies hire to do their firing, the character would say, when they don't have the guts to do the firing themselves. So when he started writing this movie a few years ago, you know, it was a different economic time, and he was writing the those firing scenes for comedic value because his films always sort of have a comic bent to them. But as he was writing it and the economic climate changed, firing scenes, you know, they're more real now. It's more what's going on now. And he couldn't write them that way. So he ended up actually putting ads in local papers where they were filming in different cities in the Midwest, trying to find people who had been downsized, who had been let go. And he uses those interviews with these people who have been laid off throughout the film. And the film, because it deals with corporate downsizing, it just feels like the right film for now. Just sort of seems to fit what's going on in the economic climate.
I'm really glad the adaptation was made because the novel came out just about on September 11th, and everything had changed in terms of airports and flying. And this really kind of funny, perceptive book that had so much to do with flying made no sense anymore.
So it
got lost completely.
Yeah, I think Reitman turned it into something else. And I think he's pretty much a shoo-in to get a nomination for adapted screenplay.
So Up in the Air was your favorite film at the festival. Is there another film or two you'd like to mention that you think our listeners should watch out for?
Well, I did like the Coen brothers film. It's called A Serious Man. It's people are saying that it's their most personal film to date. It's about a college professor in the 1960s, a Jewish college professor who's going through some hard times. His wife wants to leave him. He's having trouble with tenure, and his family doesn't understand him. And it's a film that people are kind of assuming, and probably correctly, that it's the most autobiographical. For one, it features a 13-year-old boy who's getting bar mitzvah, and people sort of assume that it's somehow based on the Coen brothers' experiences as children. So it might be a hard sell in that there aren't any stars. You know, the last film they had Brad Pitt in it. But a lot of the critics liked it coming out of the festival. Oprah was there as well. She was not in a film, but she came to support a film that she's an executive producer for, a film called Precious, which is also getting a lot of Oscar buzz. It's a film about an obese African-American teenage girl who is abused and actually carrying the second child that she's had with her father. So it's based on a best-selling novel by the poet Sapphire, and it's just also getting a lot of buzz for its performances.
So you think we'll have some good movies to talk about on the show?
Hopefully, yeah, and some great guests.
Well, Emory, thanks for reporting to us on what you saw at the Toronto Film Festival.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Emory Baldonado is one of our producers. You can read more about her experiences at the Toronto Film Festival on NPR's Monkey See blog at npr.org. And you can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.
And one man who made it fun to use your credit card passed away yesterday. Developer Mel Simon built some of America's biggest shopping malls. So our last word in business today, in his honor, is Mega Mall. Mel Simon was the man responsible for the Mall of America outside Minneapolis. That shopping center includes a speedway, an indoor amusement park, and 20,000 parking spaces. Simon was among the earliest developers to invite large department stores out of downtown to become anchor tenants at the mall. Think Sears and JCPenney. The company he founded, Simon Property Group, is the largest owner of shopping malls in the country. And that's the business news on Morning Edition. I'm Renee Montaigne at NPR West.
And I'm Steve Inskeep in Houston.
The words public and option are pretty innocuous until you put them together, and these days they become explosive. Public option refers, of course, to President Obama's proposal to create a government-run health insurance plan that would compete with private insurers. Congress is deeply divided on the issue, and NPR's David Kestenbaum reports even people who study economics aren't sure it will work.
Princeton economist and professor Uwe Reinhardt has spent his life giving out grades, so much so that he gives them out by instinct to things that don't usually get grades. Like last week, when President Obama gave his big speech to Congress on health care reform, Reinhardt took out a pencil and paper and listened. Overall, he thought, impressive, A minus. But then Obama brought up that idea of a public option.
It could provide a good deal for consumers. It would also keep pressure on private insurers to keep their policies affordable and treat their customers better.
This section got applause in Congress. Reinhardt wrote down C plus.
With all due respect for this brilliant president, I do not share as an economist his theory that a public plan would be a splendid instrument of cost control.
The idea that it would keep costs down by adding a competitor made no sense to him. We'll get to that in a second. The pitch for a public plan is that somehow it will be able to put the brakes on health care costs. So, to get a spirited economic defense of the public option idea, we have Jacob Hacker, a political scientist at Yale, also known as the father of the public option idea.
It's what I've been called. I like to think of it as my brainchild, but if that's the case, then I've been suffering a lot of brainchild abuse lately.
Here's how a public option would work, he says. People who don't get insurance through their employer could shop for a plan on what's called an insurance exchange. It would list some private health plan options and one offered by the government, the public option.
So it's really important to people understand the public plan is not some plan that swoops in and kind of sucks people up like a big spaceship. And, you know, the public plan is only available to people who are in the exchange, and you always have a choice of private insurance plans alongside it.
Hacker says the public option would drive down costs in a couple ways. It would have lower administrative expenses than private insurers, and it would have the power to bargain for lower prices.
This public plan will kind of call out the private plans, you know, keep them honest, as President Obama has put it.
This is the point in the debate where you start asking each side for evidence. Hacker says, sure, Medicare. Reinhardt also says, sure, and also points to Medicare. So Hacker first, he argues that Medicare, run by the government, has done better than private insurers at bargaining for lower prices. Point for the public option idea. Uwe Reinhardt at Princeton says, okay, but you are missing the point. The big source of waste in the system, it's not high prices for this treatment or that one. It's volume, entirely unnecessary treatments, tests, or procedures. Reinhardt says eliminating those is very difficult for any insurance company, whether it's for-profit, not-for-profit, or something run by the government, like Medicare.
I don't think Medicare really has been that. They can control prices, and they have, but they cannot control volume.
Jacob Hacker agrees overtreatment is a big problem. There are ideas for how to reduce it, he says, by paying doctors and hospitals differently. If the government had a public plan, it could lead the effort to try those out.
But the truth is, I mean, you know, you're getting to the most difficult question in healthcare reform, and the public plan is not a magic solution to this problem, but there are no magic solutions.
Uwe Reinhardt, though he gave Obama's presentation of the public option a C+, actually supports the idea. He thinks it would be simple and allow workers to move around without losing their insurance. Reinhardt just doesn't buy the claim that it will fix the bigger problem of rising costs. David Kestenbaum, NPR News.